No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect all our lives. And tonight we have a special guest. He's a friend of the show. He's been on several times before. And that's Chuck Hicks. It's Black History Month, so we had to have Chuck. We realized that you may find this funny, Chuck, that we realized last week, Karen, who helps produce the show, and I realized that we were running out of time and we hadn't had Chuck on it. Like, you can't have Black History Month without Mr. Black History. So thanks for being on our show. He grew up in the house at the center of the Civil Rights Movement in Bogalusa, Louisiana. Chuck Hicks is not only an expert in Black history, he's actually an important part of Black history. The house that he was raised in now bears a historical marker on the Civil Rights Trail in Louisiana. What an honor. Hicks is the founder of and director of the Black History Celebration Committee. He served as AFSCME president and was coordinator of the labor for the Million Man March. And we're proud of the fact that he is in 2019, he was inducted into the D.C. Hall of Fame, and his name appears on the Hall of Fame walkway. He was selected to be in the Martin Luther King Jr. permanent exhibit as a Washington, D.C. history maker. He is not – we like to – he may have been born in Bogalusa, Louisiana, but we like to claim him as one of our own. And thanks for being on the show tonight, Chuck. It's so nice of you.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm honored, and I would have been disappointed if you had not called and asked, would I be on the show? I would have picked the phone up and said, Senator Brown, how long have we known each other? Why am I not on these shows? So I am grateful always to be on the show with you. You are a man that I admire, and many people admire for your fight for statehood. You don't give up.
Thank you so much.
There are trials and obstacles that come your way from people in power to all different kinds of people. But you stay the course, and for that, we salute you, and we're proud of what you stand for.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. Let me start by saying that I came to a thing that you did on Black History a few weeks ago. You do these every year, and I heard Sam Ford tell the story of how Lift Every Voice and Sing became known as the Black National Anthem. It's a fascinating story. I never knew it. I know every lyric to the song because we sing it so often at events, but I never knew how it came to be. Why is it so important for us to understand this history? Why is that so important for America?
Well, I think it's important because it talks about, it describes the trials and tribulations that a group of that Black people were slaves had gone through. And so through all the trials and tribulations, that song still gives us hope. That is, while it talks about the trials and tribulations, we stand, forever we stand, you know, in this struggle, forever we stand. And that's important because we don't give up. When we think about what we've been through, and we've not given up, and we're not going to give up. And not only is it important for African Americans, but it is important for all Americans who believe in dignity and freedom for all people, regardless of race, color, or creed. And so it becomes important not only for the African-American community, but for people who are oppressed throughout this country and throughout the world.
Yeah, we really can't forget the struggle, right? And that's so important to us as a nation. And, you know, when I talk to my kids about civil rights, sometimes they look at me like I'm talking about the dinosaurs, you know, that they don't understand that when I was 8 years old, I went to Louisiana with my family. I went to New Orleans, and I remember black only water fountains and white only water fountains and black restrooms and white restrooms and places where African Americans weren't accepted, where they couldn't eat and where they couldn't sleep. And so it's not ancient history. It really was not that long ago. And I think it's important to keep it alive so that they always understand where people came from. Tell us about Bogalusa. Look, when I say Bogalusa, Louisiana, it sounds like a place that's, you know, like in the backwoods somewhere. Was it a place that was in the backwoods? Was it a rural community?
No, it was not. Bogalusa was a progressive southern town. It had the paper mill and the box factory, and Goodyear was there. And so the first black church ever built in Bogalusa, Goodyear built it. They built a white church and a black church. The church was Bethlehem Baptist Church. And so even during, and much of the interesting thing is, Bogalusa was a small town, but it was an independent town because in so many ways the towns around us were farms and all that. Bogalusa earned its living because it was a factory. They had a paper mill and eventually a box factory. So blacks in Bogalusa had more money than average black around them because they worked in a factory. To a degree, the wages was equal to progression in terms of blacks were not able to get the whole white supervisor job. And my father was the first black to be a supervisor after soup plow. But we had our own taxi cabs. We had our own schools. We did. We competed in state trials. We were always winning in football and drama and history and all those kinds of things. So we were indeed a very, very progressive black city. We were not a town. We were a city. And so we had lots of things that were available to us that many other places didn't have. We even had two schools. One school in the north Bogalusa and one school in south Bogalusa. And only after we got to high school were the grades merged. And so there was just a lot of things that we had in Bogalusa that other surrounding areas didn't have.
Go ahead. I was going to say, tell us about the Guardians. Tell us about your dad, what he did, because I find that absolutely amazing that he had the courage to do that.
Well, to make a long story short, my dad started off actually with the NAACP. My dad had finished high school and was smart, but he didn't go off to college, so he had a scholarship. But he and my mother got married early because she got pregnant, so he didn't think about going to college. He had a scholarship to Southern, I think it was, but he couldn't think about that because he had a family. Mm-hmm. And so one evening or something, the head of the NAACP, the treasurer, left or stepped down, and the guy who was president of the NAACP asked my dad, he said, "Mr. Hicks, you are a bright, educated person. Why don't you come and be trusted for the NAACP? You're smart. You know, and my dad was a student. He was a good student in school. He was smart. And so he agreed. And then that was right at the time that they were beginning to, civil rights movement was beginning to bubble. And so they agreed at some point on a day of testing. And the day of testing was that they were going to let blacks go into restaurants and tests being seeded and that sort of stuff. And after that, it would go back to usual. But the young people decided that they wanted freedom now. They didn't want any more testing and then back to usual. And the NAACP, when it didn't work out, it fell apart. And a new group was formed, the Bogalusa Boaters League. And my dad was started off heading that. But then there was a guy named A.T. Young. And my dad didn't want to do it. And so he asked A.T. Young if he would be president. He said, I'll be president if you'll be vice president. And so that's when they put together the Bogalusa Boaters League. And they began to challenge the city on jobs and voting rights and all the other kinds of things. And at some point, my dad filed a suit because there were no black supervisors in there in Crown Jawbank. And he won the suit and became the first black supervisor in Bogalusa. But he was still the vice president of the Voters League in terms of voters' rights. And the Bogalusa Voters League was fighting for jobs, for firemen and City Hall for jobs and J.C. Penney's and all those kind of things. And as the things got heated, and Bogalusa was a major place for the Klan, there had been a group in Jonesboro, Louisiana, that had formed something called the Deacons for Defense. And out of that, there were some people who had been in the military. And so police were not protecting the people in Jonesboro, Louisiana, who were fighting for the same kinds of privileges or rights that they were in Bogalusa. And so at one point, my dad reached out to the Deacons in Jonesboro and invited them to tell them they wanted to form a group called the Deacons. And they came down and initiated the Deacons. And the Deacons was formed on the day that Malcolm X was killed. And so that's how the Deacons got started. And, of course, the Deacons got more notoriety than any other groups of the Deacons because at some point when they were demonstrating, they had the days of testing and all of that, and they were protesting. And my dad had met with the governor and asked for these things, and he turned them down. And so they started to protest. And a group of whites decided that they were going to come down. By that time, CORE had come into Bogalusa and to help them organize and to prepare for sitting in the restaurants and do sit-ins. And so a group of whites decided they were going to come down and burn my dad's house down and lynch the family. And one of the things that when the chief of police came down to tell my dad, by then they had civil rights. They had three civil rights leaders staying in our house because nobody else would keep them. My dad said they could stay in our house. And the chief of police came down and said there's a mob of 350 white men coming down to burn and lynch this house, lynch you all, unless you get rid of those civil rights movements. And so we had to escort them out. My mother said no. And I later asked my mother in an interview why she said no. And she said, as a mother, she couldn't imagine any mother doing that to her children. And she wouldn't do it to those boys. And so when they got the word that they were coming down, my dad told some phone calls. We had people who were guarding our house. And my sister called people and said, quick, tell your husband that a mob is coming to Lynch's and to come and bring their gun. We need them to protect them. And then call other people. And they said, black people start calling black people. And the chief of police, and they were parked about a block away from our house. And they saw all these black men coming and they blocked the street off. And they wouldn't let them come through. But black people were going down other streets and cross fields to come and protect them. And so at some point, the chief of police called that mob and said, I don't think you need to come down here. There are a whole bunch of Negroes with guns. And they're in people's porches, they're in trees, and they're on the rooftop of that his family's house. So I wouldn't come down. And the next morning, make a long story short, the next morning, one of the guys who was in CORE, before they turned all the farms off, they turned all the farms off in the black community. So nobody could call you. But the guy from court was able to get a phone call out to the press, United Press in New Orleans, and told them what was happening. And it hit the wires. And so the next day, all the police, all the press was there, and they saw all these black men with guns on my dad's house and in the trees and on the roofs and everything. And they asked my dad, who are these people? And he said, they're the Deacons for Defense and Justice. And it hit the wire, and it hit the New York Times, the Chicago paper, the California, all over the country. And that's how Bogalusa became known as the group for the Deacons for Defense. But it did not start in Bogalusa. It started in Jonesboro. But because of what happened and the fire and the transaction, Bogalusa got all the notoriety. Right now, when you say the Deacons, they think of Bogalusa. And we never not give credit where credit is due. That concept started out of Jonesboro, Louisiana, out of a group of black men who had been in service, came back, and they could not get any protection for their demonstrations in Jonesboro, Louisiana. So they were militarily trained. They knew how to organize, and they started that group. And when the Deacons started, they recruited men, black men who had been in the military. And the name of the Deacons was a code name, because when people thought about the Deacons, they thought of church folks.
Right.
They group name, the black militants, or the blacks with the guns to protect the black people, then they would have been a challenge group. But the fact that it was a code name, people thought of that. When you think of Deacons, you think of church groups. And a lot of the men came out of the church, but not all of them. And that's a brief history of the Deacons.
And go ahead.
One interesting thing is also that's an article that came out about 2 years ago, and it's called The Longest March in the Civil Rights Movement. And it was in Bogalusa, Louisiana. They marched from Bogalusa to the Capitol 103 miles. There's never been a march that long.
Wow.
And that place in Bogalusa, 103 miles. It took them, I think, about almost 9 days to make that march. And that's a whole interesting story of the attacks and the fights and the things they had to go through to get to Baton Rouge.
Well, why don't we know about any of this stuff? You know, I mean, people like Emmett Till, who I had a passing, you know, somebody somewhere along the line in college, I learned a little about Emmett Till. But now the story is a big deal. They made a movie about it. How is it that things like that escape history? Is it because the people in charge get to write what history is, or, you know, no. I don't know how things like that and the Amistad and all these other episodes that seem so monumental to me, we don't know about.
Well, one of the things you have to remember is that during the civil rights movement for a long time, the only thing that was printed about civil rights movements were in black papers. If it had not been for the black press, nothing would have happened. People would not have known. People in Louisiana Weekly and the Jackson Times and the Shreveport Times, the black papers kept the civil rights movement until Emmett Till. And when the Jet magazine printed that, then all hell broke loose. And then people started printing. The white press started to print the stories.
Right.
The civil rights movement was a black issue, and if it had not been for the black press, people never would have known what was going on. But the black press kept the civil rights movement alive.
And there are a few black newspapers left, is that right? There aren't very many of them.
There are probably, I think, about 75 black newspapers out there. At one point, there was probably 300. But, you know, as in today's time, the number of just press, period, white press, look at the number of black press, white presses that have died out.
Right.
You know,
well, that's true.
You had five or six black press, white press, now you might have one.
Right.
In Bogalusa, they used to have a daily news, and they printed 7 days a week. Now, they print 3 times a week. So the power of the press with technology, with computers and cell phones and all that, has changed the whole story of the press and how people communicate. And so that not only did it affect black press, it has oppressed white press. There are major newspapers that used to be in New York and Chicago and California. They're no longer in existence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's maybe one paper, one major paper. I mean, here in the city, how many major black white papers are there? Really, it's the Washington Post and the other paper. But they're not, you know, once upon a time, we had four newspapers in this city. And community newspapers. Gone.
Yep.
So,
well, let me
communication to people, because time has changed, is a real challenge.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. Somebody just wrote in and wants to know about the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is something that was started. I knew the man that started it. He was a lawyer from either Georgia or Alabama. I can't remember. But, talk about that for a minute.
They do incredibly good work. They do. Tedious work. And they win a lot of cases, but they are meticulous in terms of the fight, the struggle going on. And they're not only, they're out of Atlanta, but they have branches all over the country. But they do an incredible job of fighting legal cases. That's what they fight. And legal cases are not something that happens overnight. And so I urge anybody who has an extra penny to support the Southern Poverty Law Center. They do incredible work. They win monumental cases. It changes the laws throughout this country. They are invaluable, not only to the civil rights movement, but to social justice movements, period. And the Southern Poverty Law Center is not just geared towards the African-American community. It's women's rights, LGBT rights. They do an incredible thing for people in this community, progressive people and people who are oppressed. They're invaluable to us.
Well, you know, I know one of their major projects when we used to work with them at the DNC, we worked with this man who was also a direct mail wizard, but they had a thing called Klan Watch. Is the Klan still out there? Do we still need keep an eye on them?
Oh, yeah, Klan. The Klan is not gone away. And people like Trump sometimes they change their color, but the spots are the same. I mean, if you look at the insurrection on the Capitol for when they were trying to defeat Bush being, the votes being counted, there's a high percentage, and probably more than they're able to document, for Klans.
Yeah.
So they have not gone away. They're still here.
Yeah, and you know what? I got to tell you, it surprises me. I mean, it just flabbergasts me that I have black friends that support Donald Trump, or black people that I know personally or have worked with. I just don't understand it. I don't understand it. This man, he just screams racism to me in every word that comes out of his mouth. But let me ask you something. This is, let's fast forward. Now there's a controversy. I can't understand why this is, but Beyonce is putting out a country album, and there's people that are criticizing her, black people and white people, criticizing her for doing this. Is this because we have a new stereotype of black people? It's okay for black people to do rhythm and blues and soul music and hip hop and whatever, but country music is a province of white people. People forgot Charlie Pride.
Well, no. Let me just briefly go back and say, way back when, there's always country music. As a matter of fact, there is a little difference between country music and blues. They both talk about the same kind of stories. One of the things I have said and been able to see in the last 10, 15 years is that one of the things that country music has done is they've been smart, that they have opened a genre for black people who want to sing country music. And there's always been black people who sung country music. They were just not very well known outside of Charlie Pride. But yeah. what country western music has done is that it has opened its doors and brought in more and more. The guy used to be something in the Bluefish. I mean, they're all...
Hody and the Bluefish, yes.
And when you looked at the Country Music Awards, I think it was last year, year before last, the two MCs were black. And one of the country music has done is that it sees that there's a whole new genre out here that we can embrace and grow. And so country music is the fastest growing music in this country. Outgoing hip-hop, outgoing all of them. There's a huge fan of country music. And now that blacks are beginning to be accepted, blacks who like, blacks who sing country music are now listening to it. They have been incredibly smart in terms of, for a long time, they closed their doors to blacks who wanted to be country western singers. Now it's wide open. It's black. You can't see a country western program without having blacks on it. And what does that say to the black community? Oh, we can now sing country. I like that, but I couldn't get into it. But now I can get into it. It's open a whole new genre for black people who want to sing country music. And that criticism is not going to last because the doors are open, and for black people who want to do that, they're going to do it. It's just like when whites start doing hip hop.
Right.
People just do that. But it's growing. You can't think of them. They're white hip hop singers. You know?
Right. No, exactly. And both my daughters were into it. Both my daughters were hip hop dancers.
The thing that, is so acceptable is that. And for Beyonce to say, I'm going to do country western and do one, that's just going to blow it wide open, brother. But, the country western industry have saying that we need, the other thing that's worth looking at is that when you look at gospel music or religious music, once upon a time there was white gospel and black gospel. Now that's growing. It's opening its doors. And those are avenues where the majority of them were white. But now blacks are moving in. And, the white population compared to the black population, we're only 13% of the population.
Right.
And the white population is what? 63% white?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So when you look at the money market, even if they don't want it, but because it's a money-making venture, they're going to take it. They see the money. They see the value in it. And when they see the value in it, black people who do country western, they're going to be accepted. You can go to shows now, even here in D.C., and there's some black country western singer.
Uh-huh. And Berry Gordy,
the
genius businessman.
It's opening doors for black people who like country western, who grew up in Mississippi, Blue House, Mississippi, or Cornfield, Arkansas, West Virginia, who grew up with that. And before you know it, there's going to be banjo and all that. That's going to live. Blacks are going to move into that because there's a difference between country western and banjo music and all that. But it's growing.
And is the problem, I remember when I was in college, I saw a friend of yours, who I later got to know a little bit, Dick Gregory, and he told us as college students that part of the problem for us as young, long-haired hippies was that we accepted the stereotypes that were put out about us, and that black people, that was a problem for black people, is they accepted the stereotypes that were put out about them. Is that what's the problem? Is Beyonce, black people that have a problem with this, is it because they see Beyonce as a standard bearer, and you think, and they see this as a capitulation somehow of embracing white music? We still see country music as white music.
I I think it's almost saying that black people sing blues and white people can't.
Right.
I think it's doors opening and that people beginning to see a different side of music, or that some people, Beyonce happens to say, oh, I like country western. I like to do a thing. There's nothing wrong with growth. You know, one of the things that I think artists do is that artists have a chance to expand, to educate, and to share genres. You know, Gladys Knight did a country western album.
Dolly Parton just did a rock and roll album. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you 100%.
I mean, I'll Always Love You. That was done by
Dolly Parton.
Yeah. And then Whitney Houston did it. The first person who did it was somebody white. Whitney Houston did it, and it grew.
Yeah.
And
it was the other way around with, I know a lot about art, but it was the other way around with rock and roll music, right? The first guys, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, all those people, they copied the great rhythm and blues people, Muddy Waters and, all the people that came before
that. Little Richard was for a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
Elvis Presley talks about his influence by black music, and all his backup singers are always black.
Yep.
But I think one of the things that art does is that it allows artists to grow, to experiment, and to educate. That when Beyonce does a country western, there's going to be a whole group of people who didn't know anything about country western learning about country western. There might be some theirs, but that's okay. All artists aren't always accepted. There are people who don't like Stevie Wonder.
I can't believe that. I can't believe there's one person on the planet that doesn't like Stevie Wonder, because he's an amazing artist, just an amazing artist. Well, let me move on to, this is another thing that came up this week that I have a really hard time with. Our friend Ron DeSantis, he's not the most open guy, liberal guy in the world. But in Florida, they're asking parents to sign, they're requiring parents to sign permission slips to have a black author come and talk about his book, which is actually has nothing to do with critical race theory or anything else. It's about a young black boy who takes pride in who he is and succeeds. It's a really, really positive story. I can't remember the name of the book. But they want parents to sign permission slips for their kids to listen to this man. How crazy is that? What is that? We're getting this backlash, are we not, from a lot of this stuff? We're reverting.
I think that part of that is fear. I think it is fear from, I think one of the challenges for white people, some white people, is that the privilege of being white has always been the privilege of being white.
Yes.
And the fact that if I was white, or if you're white, and I can be a doctor, I can be an attorney, I can be whatever, but if I walk down the street, and you're white, and you walk down the street, and you're in overalls, the privilege of being white made me get off the street. The privilege of being white doesn't have to do with money. It has to do with the privilege of being white. And when you begin to see that threatened, you begin to try to find ways to stop that growth. It's about the privilege of being white. In these places, it's not really about critical race theory. It's about keeping the privilege of being white.
Yeah, we see that. We see that with women's rights too. The privilege of privilege of being male. One thing that I think really stands out to me as a statistic is the Equal Rights Amendment, which still hasn't been passed. I think it's just had its 50 or 60th anniversary. Still hasn't been passed. When it went out to the states to be approved as a constitutional amendment, the one group of people that voted for it 100% of the time, women didn't vote for it 100% of the time, white people didn't vote for it 100%, but black legislators, every black legislator in America supported it. So, you know, it obviously they learned from the struggle and they wanted to pass on what they had learned and realize how important it was to have these few words in the Constitution that makes women equal. So, yeah, I think that that's why people want Trump. They feel that white people feel that they're afraid and they think that this man somehow is going to throw a wrench all in the works and that they're going to end up, you know, they don't have to worry about their white male dominance.
It is a fear in this country, not only white male dominance, white period, of being, of losing that privilege of being white. Privilege of being white does not have to do with money. You could be on welfare. But because you're white, you get certain privileges that if I'm working as a lawyer, I don't have that privilege because I'm black or I'm brown. You get a privilege because you're white, not because
And we rushed to that as immigrants. I can tell you that my grandmother was Northern Italian. My grandfather spoke four languages, but the only one he wasn't particularly good at was English. And my grandmother wouldn't speak to him in Italian. She would say, "Speak American. Speak English. I'm American," because she was blonde hair and blue eyed. And she wanted to pass right away, as you know, just like everybody else. My mother changed her name. She had an Italian last name. Changed her name when she went to get her first jobs. They rushed to be part of that whole white. I don't know what you want to call it, but that kind of white hierarchy.
I'll give you another good example that when you think about transitions and what happened in this country, migrations into this country. When the Irish came here and they had to fill out forms or to vote or to register or whatever, they had to put Irish. Now when they fill out a form, they simply put white.
Right. Exactly.
And and that's been the goal with every group who migrated, every immigrant group coming to this country, to be able to write white in that application, not Italian. Not Irish, but to write white, because then that gives you a privilege. It gives you the privilege of being white.
And you absolutely have to understand that to understand America, I believe. Yeah. And, you know, I know there are plenty of people out there that don't feel what you're saying, but, you know, anybody that's a student of American history has to understand how important that was and how it's still so important.
What about when they had that demonstration at the University of Virginia, when they had all those guys marching?
Yeah.
I mean, this privilege of being white is something that people don't want to give up. It's a privilege. I mean, you can be on welfare and be white, and I can be in a suit. And certain places in this country, if that woman tells me, "Get off the sidewalk," that's how I can get by. And if I don't do it, she'll scream when I'm in trouble.
Yep. That's something. And again, you know, the days. Okay, go ahead. Sorry, Chair.
I think my last thought about all of that is that it is indeed a challenge in this country in terms of racism. But it is harder in this country to be a black man than anybody else. It is difficult for black women, but it is hard to be a black man in America. It is incredibly hard to be a black man. Very difficult for black women, but it is incredibly hard to be a black man in America.
I agree. I understand that. So what can we do? What can we do as a nation? We've had people on our show talk about reparations, and I think that's a good idea, but I'm not exactly sure how it would work. I mean, I can't imagine us making direct payments to black families, but how do we make reparations? What do we do? Is affirmative action, is that a reparation?
I think that it is an important piece of an action in terms of making good what debt owed. I think what becomes more important is education educating the country about and the importance of equality. I think it is important that we allow voting rights and encouraging people to vote. I think it's important to look at the criminal justice system and make changes there. That I think this is a process that we need to look at and honestly figure out how we can do it, how we can make it better and not feel threatened by the changes that we make. That if I make this equal, I have to give up something. You don't have to give up anything. You just have to make it equal for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you something that I've dealt with for 40 years as a Democrat inside the Democratic Party. Have we taken blacks for granted in Democratic Party? I know there are a lot of people, a lot of black people in Democratic Party that feel that way, and they feel that we've lost black people to the Republican Party, which, you know, is kind of astounding because we all know that in the early days of the Civil Rights Movement that many African Americans in the South were Republicans. They were Republicans because of Lincoln. Lincoln freed the slaves. But today, there's been a migration, there's a feeling, to the Republican Party by some black people because the Democrats take them for granted. They believe that black people will always vote Democratic.
I don't know that that's always true because, of course, as you said, blacks are Republicans until King got locked up.
Yeah.
And when he got released, King said, I got a whole bunch of black folks that are votes I'm going to turn over to the Democrats. And that began the change in the migration. I think that there is indeed a challenge for blacks to demand more from the Democratic Party. I think the Democratic Party needs to
let me ask you, Chuck, what about what we're seeing in Washington, D.C. now, especially, is a rise in crime in the black neighborhoods. And it's a lot of black on black crime, which has always been, you know, during the drugs of the 1980s drugs epidemic, your crack epidemic in Washington, it was black teenagers that were being killed. What can we do to mitigate this in the black neighborhood? What do you think is specifically responsible for this? Is it because blacks have proximity to blacks? We still live in segregated neighborhoods, or is there something else going on? Okay, I think folks that we have lost Chuck Chick because he was on his cell phone and maybe his cell phone went dead. If we can't get him back, I will just finish the show talking about what a great guy this is and some of the things we've talked about in the past. Do we have him back on, Doug, or have we lost him? Yeah, I think probably his cell phone. It sounded like his cell phone went dead. He's out of town, but he was kind enough to be on the show anyway. Okay, well, in the meantime, in the meantime, let me just say that this is such an important issue today. I think very often, even during Black History Month, we don't. We think that all this is done.
Hello?
Yeah. Hi, Chuck. I'm sorry we lost you for a second. Is the how about this feeling that many of us seem to have on the liberal side that the civil rights movement is over, that we've accomplished? You know, we elected a black president. What about that? It certainly is not over, and there's certainly a long way to go, right?
I think that the civil rights movement is not over. I think that the challenge is that you look that black space in communities. I think as you look at the problems that Latin Americans face in this country, that there is a ongoing struggle. And I think in terms of looking at communities, I think a major part of the challenge for people in low-income community is jobs and training, so that, you know, that there's a future, there's a hope that things will get better. I think that working with people who have been involved in crime have better ideas about how we can better change the neighborhood, change communities, and change young people in terms of believing in this country. And that we need to try to make things more equal and fair for people economically. I think a whole lot of this has to do with economics. I think a whole lot of this needs to begin that we need to begin to instill in our young kids from grade school up about the possibility of what can happen and examples of how they can make it happen, how they can be a part of it. I think we also need to encourage as many community individuals, churches, and other organizations to roll up their sleeves and figure out what my role is. You know, everybody has a role, but we need to figure out what my role is to help make this better, to help make changes. And I don't think that we need to be out there listening and say that this is all going to happen in 2 or 3 years. I think that this did not happen overnight. I think that the problems are not going to be solved overnight, but I think that we can begin to solve them. I don't think they're insurmountable. I think we have to figure out what steps we take, how we do this brick by brick, step by step. And I think we need to also listen to young people. What they're feeling and how they feel. And then, you know, this is more than just economic. I think bullying plays a part in this. I think mental illness plays a part in this. There are a whole bunch of factors here that we need to begin to look at. It ain't just about jobs. I think it's about bullying. I think it's about mental illness. I think it's about drugs. There are a whole lot of things that are playing into young people's lives.
But let me ask you,
how do we address?
Let me ask you, we just had somebody text in another comment, which is that over the years, black people have tended to be magnanimous in their approach to the world, that they've gone through this struggle, but there's a lesson to be learned in black history about the magnanimity of black people. And it's true. You know, I don't know why white people are afraid of the ones that are of black people, because the history of black people is not a particularly violent history. And as a rule in America, they have not been a particularly violent group of people. So I don't know where the fear comes from. But is that an important lesson that we need to learn, to be gracious and to pass on to the next generation what we have learned? And is this part of the black experience?
I think it's things that we need to look at and figure out how we navigate these issues. But I certainly think that in terms of looking at, this is not just looking at the black community. I think it's looking at the entire country. And I think that, like I said before, part of this has to do with the privilege of being white. I just think that it is something that people are used to having, or afraid of giving up. That if I give up being white, then what does that mean for me? Does that mean that black people now get more than I get?
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
You know?
That's.
I can.
That was certainly the attitude in my, you know, I grew up in an immigrant family. My grandmother and grandfather were immigrants, and that was certainly their attitude, you know, that it was a zero-sum game. Every time you gave something to somebody else, they took something away from you, and that's certainly not the case, you know, and certainly hasn't been our example here in America. It seems the more we give in America, the more we get in the long run. Yeah. But we're running out of time here, Chuck, so I want to ask you, is there anything you want to say that I haven't asked you?
No, I think that these are profound discussions. I don't claim to have all the answers. I don't claim to always be right. What I do claim is that I think it's worth looking at and figuring out how we get from A to B, that it can happen. And it should happen, and it will happen. And it can only happen when we can come together and figure out how do we make these steps together. Not me as a black person, but me as an American, black, white, brown, whatever nationality it is, that this is a project, a struggle that we're in collectively. That the fact that there are so many, when we look at the attacks on Asians in this country, the numbers are significantly multiplied compared to the population. Why is that?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? You know, when you look at the number of Asians who've been attacked, hate crimes and stuff in this country, it's far outreaching in terms of population than black. And look at Latin America and their challenges and problems. And that is not problem for America to address, but we have to address it. And I think a lot of it has to do with wealth. Who controls the wealth in this country that makes people think I can't get my share? That there's only a small percentage of people who own the majority of wealth in this country. And that's a challenge for all of us who are working, who are seniors, who are from biracial communities, who are minorities. And that something that's a picture we have to address. It's just not also about racism, it's about how capitalism works to keep us apart.
And yes, that's absolutely true. And it's getting worse every year, unfortunately.
Yes.
Well, Chuck Kicks, thank you so much for being on the show. Happy Black History Month. I look forward to seeing you in the future. I just want to add one thing about this man. After knowing him for several years, he's one of the nicest human beings I've ever met in my entire life. He's an amazing person.
I will tell you
on the show.
About me being honored at the arena stage on the 26th. And I hope you share it with everybody. It's a wonderful honor to be.
Tell people how they come to that, Chuck. Please, go ahead.
It's to say that 7 o'clock on the 26th, it's open and it's free. Please come and help me receive this award because of people like you and people who listen to me and support the things that I do that I get this award. So it's not me, it's all of us. Please come
all
out
right.
and support. Be a part
so
of
let's
it.
Everybody do that on the 24th at Arena State. I'm sorry, what 26th. Day is it? 26th. Yeah. Monday the 26th at Arena Stage.
Put on by the
and we'll put Station. Something up on our website about it, too. And thank you so much, Chuck Kicks. You know, we leave you with the song every show, and we dedicate this to Chuck Kicks and all the brave people that stood up in Bogalusa, Louisiana, and still stand up today for what's right in America. Since I brought it up at the beginning of the show, here's Lift Every Voice and Sing by Alicia Keys. Thanks, Chuck. Hope to see you soon.
All right. Thank you.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the of liberty, let our rejoicing rise.
in the capital of this nation. 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.